themselves. We start with the Campbellite controversy. One of the most dramatic Baptist battles came over Campbellism. Campbellism, like the soup, same name as it. Alexander Campbell was born in Ireland and was associated there with Baptist reformers. He chose to come to the United States so he might enjoy the religious freedom available to everyone. He became convinced of the error of infant baptism and was baptized by immersion in a Baptist church. He began an independent church that soon joined a local Baptist association. Campbell gained a great reputation as a debater. It's very, very common in those days for Baptist preachers, and as he leaves the Baptist, starts the Disciples of Christ, for Baptist preachers and Disciples of Christ preachers to have public debates. Sometimes they like to still do that. I had an experience just a few weeks ago. I knew the story, but to actually be where it happened, I actually stayed on a farm where I was preaching in Tennessee. And on the farm, in a little drawdown valley in the farm, is where this took place. A disciple of Christ and a Baptist preacher were having a public debate. And it got so heated that during the debate, the disciple of Christ preacher pulled a gun out and shot the Baptist preacher and killed him. And the spot that happened was on that farm. I didn't know that. I'm staying there overnight while I'm preaching at a church, and they asked me if I wanted to see it. I mean, it was just right down the draw, they would call it. And the spot, and there's a little thing there that marks it happened back in the 1800s, a long time ago. Most of the debates did not end that way. Most of the debates ended with both sides claiming victory and going home. Well, during this time, Barton W. Stone was dismissed by the Presbyterians because of his doctrine. He taught baptism of believers only, which was contrary to Presbyterian doctrine. But now here's the kicker, the difference between Stone and Campbell and the Baptist. He also taught that one had not really believed until he was baptized. He said, you haven't finished believing till you go into the water. No matter how you phrase it, what does that mean you end up teaching? Works, and the baptism saves you. You're unsaved when you're standing there dry. You get in the water, out of the water, and now you're saved. No matter how, what words you use, what it teaches is that baptism saves you. Well, Campbell and Stone joined forces and began to think of themselves as a Reformation movement among Baptists. That's what they called themselves, Reformation movement among Baptists. Baptists began to debate over the relationship between salvation and baptism, and the doctrine that baptism was essential to salvation became known as Campbellism. The idea that baptism was essential to salvation became known as Campbellism. A number of Baptist churches, especially in the South, began to form new groups. The followers of Stone began to consider themselves the independent Christian churches. That's what they would call themselves, independent Christian churches. And the followers of Alexander Campbell became known as the Disciples of Christ. The separation between Baptists and the Campbellites was complete. Baptists and Campbellites usually refused to recognize each other's baptism. They refused to recognize each other's baptism, church membership, and ordination. A later group of Campbellites, dissatisfied with the growing liberalism among the Disciples of Christ, called themselves the Church of Christ. And it came out of the Baptists. Interest me, I have Alexander Campbell's memoirs and have read them. They will teach you today that you have to be baptized in the Church of Christ to be saved. But Alexander Campbell himself was baptized in a Baptist church, which is an interesting contradiction. The little denomination I was saved in was technically out of that movement, but the pastor that preached the gospel to me, led my father to the Lord, pastored the church where I was at, did not believe the official doctrine. He preached the truth. But that was their official doctrine, that you weren't really saved till you were baptized. And then you had to hold on to a good Christian testimony to remain saved. The question of slavery was a difficult one for Baptists. In England, John Howard, a Baptist pastor, had been a leader for prison reform and a spokesman against slavery in that country. In 1833, English Baptists had led the British West Indies to outlaw slavery, and they called on their American brethren to do the same. As early as 1789, John Leland, the great Baptist preacher associated with our American Constitution, had called for a gradual end to slavery. Baptists differed greatly in their reaction to slavery issues. Some preached against slavery, but did not consider it a matter for the local church to deal with. Some Baptist churches, the master and the slaves were both members. They'd sing in a choir together, etc. Other churches would preach against slavery and not allow a slave owner to be a member. Some churches would preach against slavery. They'd allow slave owners to be members, but they couldn't hold an office. And then you went into the complications. Okay, say you don't allow slave owners to be a member in your church. Will you participate in a Baptist fellowship with preachers that do or who even own slaves themselves? All kinds of positions and all kinds of debate. While other churches accepted slave owners as members but would not allow them to hold office, Others considered slavery a necessary social evil. So what else are you going to do? And here was the problem that kept America from dealing with slavery. You had millions of slaves. Slavery had quit being economically profitable. And so the North outlawed it. But in the South, it was not as unprofitable because of the emphasis on agriculture. But this was the real debate. If we outlaw slavery, what are we going to do with these 3 million people? Okay, you're free. You can go now. Where do you go? What do you do for a living? Where do you get housing? Where do you get food? That's why some, like John Leland, said, we've got to end it gradually, or you're going to have 3 million people you don't know what to do with. But you could never, ending slavery meant economic disruption. You could never get people to agree to go through the economic disruption, so we went through a much worse economic disruption, the American Civil War in the aftermath. The question haunted relations between preachers. Could an anti-slavery preacher fellowship with a preacher who owns slaves? Would you support missionaries that own slaves? For example, was a debate. Could he fellowship with a pastor who did not own slaves but who accepted slave owners in his church? Tremendous confusion and great difference of opinion existed among Baptist leaders over this complex issue. Baptists led the way in abolishing slavery in the northern states. However, Baptists in the South were among the leaders in fighting to maintain slavery there. The leader of the Illinois Friends to Humanity Association, an anti-slavery group, was a Baptist preacher who called for all anti-slavery Baptists to break all fellowship with Baptists who own slaves. In Indiana, leaders of the Underground Railroad, a system for helping runaway slaves flee to Canada, were Baptist. If you could get to Indiana, especially if you could get to Indianapolis, all you'd do is find a Baptist church, and they would help you get the rest of the way, which was deeply resented by many of the Southern Baptist churches. Some of the Baptist missionaries in Burma broke relations with the Missionary Baptist Convention in 1840. The convention had sent some missionaries who were slave owners to the mission field, and they had taken their slaves with them. How do you think the people of Burma reacted when they saw Baptist preachers with slaves? And so some of the other Baptists said, we don't want anything to do with them. We don't have association with them. Many of the missionaries felt this greatly hurt the testimony of the entire Baptist cause in Burma. A convention of anti-slavery Baptists was held in New York, and they formed a missionary society to work with those missionaries who were anti-slavery. But that mission society only helped missionaries who were totally against slavery. In 1841, the Missionary Baptist Convention issued a statement of neutrality on the slavery issue. I said, we'll be neutral. But there are some subjects you can't stay neutral on, no matter how hard you try. 1844, the convention refused to appoint James E. Reeve as a missionary unless he was willing to free the slave he owned. That's not neutral. I understand it, but that once you do that, you're not neutral anymore. In fact, there's no way to be neutral on slavery. And there are other issues there's no way to be neutral on. One of the big cries now of the left-wing evangelicals is to be neutral on gay marriage. That doesn't work. Either for it or against it, there is not a neutral position. Okay. Well, this caused many southern churches to withdraw from the convention, and they soon formed their own missionary convention. Formed their own missionary convention. Most Southern Baptist churches, even those who were anti-slavery, felt the need to identify with this Southern Baptist Convention. And this doesn't register much with people up here, but in the South, in many states, the Southern Baptist Convention is the largest religious group in the state. It is the second largest religious group in the country, exceeded only by Roman Catholicism. It is the largest religious group in the South. And it's hard for us up here, where there aren't that many of us, to comprehend the impact of being in the convention in the South. Bible colleges. Another prominent battle among Baptists came over the concept of Bible colleges and seminaries. Bible colleges and seminaries. My family did not believe in Bible college. My mother was ashamed of my going to Bible college. She would not allow me to send invitations to my Bible college graduation to my family because they did not believe in Bible colleges. I had an aunt that came anyway, but for the most part, they just shake their head in disappointment that somebody in their family, somebody in the Fairchild clan, would do something as evil as go to a Bible college. Some Baptists believe that the influence of schools of higher education would cause people to look to the schools instead of the Scripture. Would look to the schools instead of the Scripture. And they were afraid that education might destroy the concept of sole authority Scripture. They were afraid that education might destroy the concept of sole authority Scripture. And education doesn't, but the wrong kind of loyalty to a school does. When I was at President of Landmark Baptist College, I used to preach, if you ever have to pick between Landmark Baptist College and a Bible, pick the Bible. I will say without apology, if you ever have to pick between Dayspring Bible College and a Bible, pick the Bible. Our loyalty to the Bible ought to be greater than our loyalty to a Bible college. The Bible doesn't change. If a Bible college that was effective and successful and loyal to the Bible in training us changes, your loyalty to the Bible stays. Well, the primitive Baptists as well as the separate Baptists identified themselves with this way of thinking. Now, the next sentence is going to come as a huge surprise. The anti-school Baptists never experienced much growth. And their influence on Baptist affairs in general seemed to diminish with each passing decade. If you've ever listened to a sermon, I've listened to a few, from the preachers who are anti-Bible college and proud of not being trained or educated, they can be terribly hard to listen to. And since they don't have content, they yell a lot. And I mean, they can be literally painful to listen to. And so consequently, not that many people come to listen to them. By 1902, there were 36 Baptist universities, 29 Baptist colleges, and 7 Baptist seminaries in America. Very quickly, the debate over Sunday schools. Sideline debate to the Bible college issue was the battle over the idea of Sunday school. That's hard for us to comprehend because every church I know has Sunday school today, but it was very controversial at one point. 1780, Robert Raikes had begun a special school for teaching children on Sunday in London. Raikes himself was a Methodist, but a Baptist deacon, William Fox, seized upon the idea, and soon Baptist churches all over London had special Sunday morning schools for children. We take it for granted, but that was a new idea. The first recorded Sunday school in the United States was at the Second Baptist Church in Baltimore in 1804. Many churches seemed to feel this was an excellent way to advance their ministries, although some Baptists, usually those opposed to missions and Bible colleges, felt the schools must be opposed as a modern invention. This was a battleground for several decades, but eventually the Sunday school became a regular feature of almost all Baptist churches. Regular feature. And you can certainly say in the battle over Sunday school won. The next is masonry. Masonry was another area of controversy among Baptists. Some Baptists considered the Masonic lodges a secret organization of individuals dedicated to the overthrow of the United States. Masons were accused of occult practices and paganism. Dedicated to the overthrow of the United States, Masons were accused of occult practices and paganism. So many different people throughout the United States felt this way that an anti-Masonic political party was formed. This party thought the Masons were the biggest threat to the United States and the most important thing the government could do would be eradicate Masonry. It's a whole political party that lasted for a while. Other Baptists believed the Masons were simply a social organization with no religious significance. Dallas Billington, who built in his time the largest Baptist church in the United States, was an active Mason. And if you were in his office, he had a huge Masonic symbol that covered this whole wall behind his desk. Other preachers, I have preacher friends who still think the Masons are the biggest problem that we face. To be completely honest, I think they're silly. If you've ever seen their ceremonies, their programs, I just think they're silly personally. But if you read the Masonic Bible, the footnotes are terrible. Heretical. And I have a Masonic Bible given to me by somebody I led to the Lord that was a Mason. Should Masons be excluded? The same questions follow the slavery debate rose again. Should Masons be excluded from church membership or just church offices? Or should they be accepted freely? Could anti-Mason pastors fellowship with neutral pastors? What about pastors who are Masons? The influence of Masons among Baptist churches gradually diminished. But this controversy still exists, gradually diminished, but this controversy still exists in a limited way. Liquor. It may come as a surprise that this was a controversy. My uncle, who considered himself a theologian, and in terms of presenting the primitive Baptist view he was also owned a tavern. When I went to Bible college, he offered me a job paying much more than Bible college students normally make, but it was at his tavern, and I couldn't accept. I made about a third of what he offered me during college, and the family used to just shake their heads and could not understand that. Well, a similar controversy arose over liquor, with many Baptists believing that faithful Christians must never use intoxicating drink as a beverage. Count me on that list. Some Baptists openly fought this idea as an infringement upon the doctrine of soul liberty. And I mean, this was a considerable debate among Baptists. It's hard for us to comprehend because it's clear the anti-liquor forces won this debate as drunkenness got to be more and more of an issue in the United States. But when W.A. Criswell, back in the 50s, preached a sermon at the Southern Baptist Convention, no beer in Baptist icebox. That created a stir. There's no grounds for a Baptist. That day they had iceboxes, not refrigerators. There's no grounds for a Baptist ever being found with beer in their icebox. That was controversial in that day. Most of the leadership of the anti-missions group, which is what my family was, were also pro-alcohol, which is what my family was. My mom used to say everybody drinks beer. Some of them just don't admit it. Well, I've managed to get to age 60 without the first drop of a beer. So it's not everyone. The irony was my father, who was an atheist and who drank, was adamant that I would never touch a drop of alcohol. He drilled that into me as a child. I'd be afraid today that he'd come back from the dead. He drilled that into me so much as a child. My atheist father said, you never drink, you'll never drink, you'll never have a drink, you'll never have a sip. My Baptist family, not a problem, you got to wait till you're 18. After you're 18, you know, that's normal. I even had a cousin who, they had a graduation party for me when I graduated from high school. That was acceptable. And so they threw, my uncle threw a nice party for me, and I mean, lots of food and stuff, and I brought my friends from the youth group there. And my cousin was there, and he looked at me from across the room and said, it's about time you grow up. Took a beer can, pulled the tab, and there's a way to throw a can with a little spin on it that the liquid won't come out. So he tossed me a can, no beer goes anywhere. I catch it, but I'm mad. So I throw it back at him, and I don't know how to spin it. Beer goes everywhere, all over my youth group friends that came from church and all that. They've all got the smell of beer on them. And I spend the evening going from parent to parent to parent to explain to them what happened, and it wasn't their fault, and all that kind of thing. That did not endear me to my family's attitude toward liquor. The girl I had dated for 3 years was there. She's a year younger than me. Beer all over, sitting next to me when I did that. And I had to go explain to her mom and dad why she smelled like beer. Not one of my favorite memories. Okay. This was an area of much separation among Baptists, but by the 20th century, few Baptist preachers openly advocated the use of liquor. It's coming back. It's coming back as a debate. But that's a relatively new debate. Few Baptist preachers openly advocated the use of liquor. The second coming of Christ. The other great controversy among Baptists was over the second coming of Christ. Some Baptists were premillennialists, believing in the return of Christ to rule and reign upon the earth for 1,000 years. Some were postmillennialists, believing that Christ would return after 1,000 years of peace upon the earth, which we would achieve without him. Smaller number were amillennialists, believing that Christ would return, but there would be no millennium. Premillennialists, postmillennialists, amillennialists. 100 years of bitter debate separated the three positions. Premillennialism eventually became by far the majority position. And this became such a strong issue that you reached a point there wasn't really any fellowship between the three groups. If you were amill, you didn't have anything to do with premill or postmill and so forth. I personally, this debate has so faded that I personally have never met a preacher that believed in the postmillennial return of Christ. I've read some, but I've never met one. The prophetic teaching of one Baptist preacher, William Miller, led many to respect the return of Christ in the 1840s. William Miller. And most people are amazed to find out he was a Baptist. He never quit being a Baptist preacher. He preached, Christ has to come, 1843, preached Baptist truth past that, but he preached Christ had to come in 1843, had it figured out. When he didn't come in 1843, he recalculated and preached that it was 1844. So he preached another year. Christ didn't return in 1844. He admitted he was wrong and dropped all that and continued to be a Baptist preacher. And when this was proved correct, Miller returned to being a normal Baptist preacher. His followers, however, developed into the Seventh-day Adventist cult. Group of the people who'd gathered to wait for the return of Christ wouldn't admit it didn't happen. So they decided Christ had returned in a spiritual sense, not a physical one. And they formed the Seventh-day Adventist cult. Its followers, however, developed into the Seventh-day Adventist cult. And then lastly, the fundamentalist-modernist controversy. We've stressed this through the course. When the devil cannot stop the work of the Lord through persecution, he tries to stop it through infiltration. The greatest controversy among Baptists arose in the 20th century. Beginning late in the 19th century, there arose a group of theologians who carried the name Baptist but denied the authority of Scripture. Carried the name Baptist, but they denied the authority of Scripture. This was so unheard of that there appears to be very little awareness of what they were teaching at first. Very little awareness of what they were teaching at first. And by the way, this comes primarily out of two schools, a Baptist school in New York and University of Chicago School of Religion, which was a Baptist school in Chicago. Still exists. These were the centers of Baptist modernism. That is one reason why the influence was strong in Chicago and why you find lots of Baptist churches today that are called Baptist that are modernist. Under the influence of that seminary 100 years ago, or almost 100 years ago, these places will have impact first the closest to where they are. This is why Ravenswood Baptist Church had a battle over this in 1934, because some of the seminary professors that originated modernism among Baptists were attending Ravenswood and were members at Ravenswood, the church I pastor. And they had to vote them out of the church membership. They had to get rid of them. Well, such Baptist teachers as William Clark, Walter Rauschenbusch, Shaler Matthews, and Harry Emerson Fosdick challenged the authority of the Bible and developed a constantly expanding following in Baptist educational circles and in certain large urban churches. Baptists who belonged to either the Northern or Southern Baptist Convention faced a great dilemma. Should they expel this group for their membership in defense of the sole authority of Scripture? Some argued the doctrine of soul liberty meant that Baptists could not judge one another doctrinally. Since we answer to God, so Baptists could not judge one another doctrinally. Since the conventions took no action, the modernist element within them grew and within local churches. Many who opposed the modernist element left the conventions and formed new organizations or simply functioned without being a part of any organization. Left the conventions, formed new organizations, or simply functioned without being a part of any organization. Of course, many Baptists had always done this. When Ford Porter, again, this is the preacher who founded the Bible college I was trained at, was Cindy's pastor during clear up till she married me. And he was at the hospital when my wife was born. At that time, he was pastoring in Indianapolis, but first he pastored in Princeton, Indiana, tried to leave the Northern Baptist Convention in protest over modernism. The convention tried to retain control over his church. Told him he couldn't leave. This led to a 2-year legal battle, finally decided by the courts. And this is huge, because it's the legal precedent for all the churches leaving after that. The court ruled that Baptist churches were, by definition, independent. So that was the definition of a Baptist church. They were independent. Which goes back to the very first class that we had 27 sessions ago. What is a Baptist? And there's a 6-part definition. And part of the definition is that they're independent. And the Supreme Court legal clerks came up with that definition of being a Baptist. I'm glad we don't have to count on the court getting it right today. But they came up with this definition of Baptist. Well, they're independent. So if a majority of people want to leave, there's nothing the convention can do to stop them. Okay. This legal decision paved the way for thousands of Baptist churches to withdraw from the two largest Baptist conventions. An issue still being debated today. There's still churches leaving the Southern Baptist Convention. Independent churches going back into the Southern Baptist Convention is a trend today too, but there's still churches leaving. And this is the legal precedent all the way through. Very quickly, I got about 3 minutes for one page of notes here. Turn to the next one, landmarkism. And this is something I have been confused with because I used to be the president of a college called Landmark Baptist College. But it was not a college that held landmark doctrine. The preacher had taken the name for that college because of the verses in the Proverbs that say to uphold the old landmarks. That's what he was referring to. There's a movement called landmarkism. And trust me, I had to explain this about every day of the 9.5 years I was there, and I'm still explaining it to some people. I have a suspicion that when I first met Brother Scudder, he looked at me with questions in his background because of that name, just because of some of the things that he asked. And I have to understand that. I cannot tell you how many times during that 9.5 years I explained this. Well, the movement called Landmarkism actually began in the mid-1800s. Led by James R. Graves and Jim Pendleton, these Baptists took a strong exclusivist view. Strong exclusivist view. They went further than the common Baptist view that Baptists represented the best, most consistent expression of New Testament Christianity. I'm perfectly comfortable with that. The purest New Testament churches are Baptists, and I have no problem with that. But they went farther than this. They believed Baptists were the only New Testament Christians. The only New Testament Christians. And would not fellowship with any non-Baptist. Would not fellowship with any non-Baptist. Many would not fellowship with any who were not Landmarkers. And one of the most embarrassing moments of my ministry, I'm sitting on the platform of a church, preacher's conference, waiting to be introduced to preach. And the pastor's up explaining how they don't fellowship with anyone who doesn't hold this position. And I realize he assumes, because I'm the president of a college with this name, that I hold this position. And he has just explained, in the process of getting ready to introduce me, that they don't fellowship with anybody who doesn't hold this position. That was a horribly awkward moment. I got up and preached, and I was scheduled to preach a couple more times, but I talked with him afterwards. I didn't know what to do. I thought about not preaching even as he introduced me, but said, man, that's enormously awkward. But I'm sitting on a platform while he's explaining this. And I, oh, Lord, help me. And I just assumed, and he just assumed, and here we are. That's not the worst experience I ever had like that, but that was one I remember. Many would not fellowship with any who were not Landmarkers, and many carried the thought further and believed that Baptists have a special place in heaven. That's called the Baptist bride position. The Baptists have a special place in heaven, that only Baptists are in the bride of Christ, and that other, at least they believe other people are saved, the other people saved are the guests at the wedding, you know, the marriage supper of the Lamb. This movement experienced a great amount of growth as Baptists left their respective conventions and associated with Landmarkism. Certainly, there was no question of modernism among the Landmarkers. I'll have to say that out of all the Baptist groups out there, they're ones who don't let modernism make any inroad at all. I preached in 2011 at a message on the history of the King James Bible that I was asked to preach a lot. I think I preached it 44 times in 2011. And two different guys that were Landmarkers invited me to preach for them, and they knew. I mean, they knew who they were and they knew who I was, but they wanted that message for their people. And they were fine and wonderful and gracious, and I went in and stuck to the subject and didn't do anything that would be a problem for them. But both of them took tremendous criticism for having a non-Landmarker in their pulpit, even to speak on the King James issue. I felt bad for them, but it was what it was. Finally, New Evangelicalism. One new aspect of the fundamentalist modernist debate soon emerged that is called New Evangelicalism. New Evangelicals maintain a commitment to the concept of personal salvation. They maintain at least some concept of loyalty to the idea of an inspired Bible. However, they advocate trying to find common ground for fellowship with various religious philosophies and doctrines. Their thought is that we're going to work with the modernists, we're going to work with the cults, we're going to work with these people, and we will sort of infiltrate them. We'll turn the infiltration thing around. This controversy has had a great impact on Baptists. The leading spokesman for the new evangelical position is a Baptist, the well-known evangelist Billy Graham. Graham, easily the most famous preacher in the United States, openly held citywide crusades sponsored by modernists as well as doctrinal conservatives. Example, Chicago, and relatively recent crusades, where they would call upon everybody to sponsor it. The Roman Catholic diocese would sponsor it, and the Seventh-day Adventists would sponsor it, and the Mormons would sponsor it, and the Pentecostal groups would sponsor it. And the last crusade wasn't actually a Billy Graham crusade, but similarly organized crusade, Greg Laurie, they lobbied me and lobbied me and lobbied me to support it. And I said, I cannot. What message do you send? In a crusade where the priests and the Seventh-day Adventists and the Mormons and everybody and all the modernists are on the platform sponsoring it, what are you teaching about salvation? They cannot. Well, it was not unusual to see modernists, Roman Catholics, Seventh-day Adventists, charismatics, and evangelicals from various groups united in a Billy Graham crusade. I think Franklin Graham is a better, stronger preacher, but he still has this same philosophy of sponsorship. Again, we get to the question. This philosophy created a number of questions for Baptists. Should a Baptist participate in such a program? If he refuses, as the fundamental Baptists do, can he fellowship with those Baptists who do choose to participate? Some questions led to a serious split within the conservative Baptist movement. And that is very much the issue that is in front of us today. It's being debated in different formats, but that's still the issue. Very quickly. This chart sums up what we've been looking at through 27 hours now. It comes from the book, The New Testament Trail of Blood, by J.M. Carroll. And the point of his book was twofold. One is that Baptists are not Protestants. You hear that said all the time. I was just talking with a friend of mine last night. He and I agree on biblical text issues and have worked together some things on biblical text. But he keeps calling us Protestants. And I keep reminding him, I'm not a Protestant. I'm a Baptist. We were never part of the Protestant movement. And he wanted to demonstrate that these issues had been around long before the Reformation. And then he wanted to make this clear. The cost of the truth throughout the centuries has been people who are willing to sacrifice even to their lives. And that wherever you find the truth, you find blood being shed because of loyalty to the truth. And so he draws this line, starting with the apostles, going through, referring to groups that we studied in class that held for the truth. He says, wherever you find them, you find bloodshed. People burned at the stake. People with their heads cut off. People fed to wild dogs. In more recent centuries, people shot. And here and there, in other areas, somebody comes across the truth and will stand for the truth, and you'll find them paying for truth with their life. Okay? Savonarola never left the Catholic Church, but he preached salvation and got burned at the stake in a very public ceremony. And they'd drawn up a document for him to sign confessing that everything he taught was heresy. He wouldn't sign it. They forged his signature and cut out his tongue so that he couldn't tell anybody. And then took him to the stake and burned him. But trumpeting, here's his confession. And if this is not truly your signed confession, tell the folks. And he didn't say anything. He couldn't say anything. His tongue had been cut out. Okay? Wherever you find the truth, for century after century after century, you find the shedding of blood. So Mr. Carroll illustrated that with this red line from the apostles, straight line through, as you go through all the various groups we talked about, the Paulicians and so forth, Donatus Novatians and so forth. Up here he's showing the state church when they begin to persecute, when they begin to practice infant baptism and going through the indulgences and so forth and all the things through that. And there are groups up here that come out of those regions and areas preaching the truth. But all the way, tracing it as a trail of blood. And you get up here when Baptists start coming to the United States. And you say, well, where is the trail of blood? It's not in the United States. And so we assume that it doesn't exist. But it's in other countries. There are still people paying the price. It's not been that long ago. Filipino preachers were executed in Saudi Arabia for teaching these same doctrines. In other parts of the world, in other settings. And so we get used to thinking the trail of blood ends here. But as I mentioned, I've been in Vietnam with underground preachers. And whenever they have something for the underground pastors, they invite the widows of pastors to come. And we're talking to a lady there, and when Vietnam fell to the communists, they knew they would come after the preachers. Her husband was a Baptist preacher, and he said, I'm not going to run and hide. He left her at home and the children at home, but went to the church. So I'm going to the church. I will be at the church in my office. They will not have to hunt me. She never saw him again. The young man I was telling you about, the Vietnamese young man that was training, they executed his father and they made him dig his father's grave. And then put his father in and with the whole family watching, shot him. Trail of blood's not over. I go to Syria. And preaching in at that time was the only legal above ground Baptist church in Syria. Independent Baptist Church. And the reason it was legal, Secretary of State Jim Baker back in the 1990s had flown on an airplane and sat next to this pastor. And they got to talking. At that time, we had a good relationship with Syria. And we were allies with Syria in the first Gulf War. And Secretary of State Baker personally called the dictator Assad, the father of the current dictator, and said, this is a wonderful man and he loves the Lord. I implore you not to give their church any trouble. So they let them come above ground and let them have a church building, and they would get harassed by groups and so forth, but the Assad family let them come above ground. So when I go there, they got a building and they got a sign. And here they are. The other independent Baptist churches are underground. Most of them are meeting in somebody's house. And I had a meeting with 12 with the above ground pastor and 12 underground preachers. I mentioned a meeting earlier in this class. We got a picture taken with the underground preachers, two at a time. And I got my arms around them, and these two, and then these two, and these two, and I've got these six pictures. Not long after I came back to the United States, one of the men that I'm standing there with was preaching in his living room, and militants fired into the window, they could see him through the window, fired into the window and killed him during the middle of a sermon. See, every now and then, being human, a thought might cross my mind that I have it rough or I don't have everything I want to have or, you know, that my life is difficult. You know what I do when that thought comes to my mind? I get the picture of me standing with him. I was in my living room last night sitting watching television with my wife, not the least bit concerned that anybody was going to fire. I get him in a pulpit on Sunday morning without any concern that anybody's going to shoot me for being there. The trail of blood hasn't ended in the world. We've been really fortunate here in the United States, no doubt about it. You could almost say that in the United States, the trail of blood stopped. But it still goes on. It still goes on. And you look at this, and you look at the red, and you understand the thought behind the term, trail of blood. Want to find the truth? Go see where the folks are being killed. Go see where the preachers are being killed. You want to find the truth? See who's paying a price. And all through history, the truth keeps popping up in a direct line, or here and there without the direct line, somebody studying the Bible, and the truth pops up. But when you follow the truth, you follow a trail of blood. Because we have been so fortunate in the United States, and I said earlier, this is a historical anomaly. this is not what normally happens. We're used to this is what normally happens, serve the Lord, go to church on Sunday, go out to a nice restaurant afterwards, and take a nap Sunday afternoon, and if you're dedicated, you come back on Sunday night, and then you go back home and you check the sports scores, and you know that this is life. This is our idea of hardship. Somebody criticized me. Okay? I have, and this happens to people who write and speak and deal with controversial topics. I have tremendous number of critics on the internet. I mean, it's just nonstop. And people ask me sometimes if that frustrates me. You know how many of them have shot at me? None. Do you know how many of them have threatened to burn me at the stake? None. Do you know how many of them have tried to break in the house and grab my family? None. I just don't consider them important. What have they done? Criticize me? Do you know how well I sleep at night knowing they criticize me? If I was wondering somebody was going to break in and grab my wife and she might get burned at the stake for what I preached, that might worry me. I might have trouble with that. When you understand the history of it all the way through, and you understand the price people have paid all the way through. John Bunyan preaching his first Sunday out of prison for not having a license, without a license, and you know he knows he's going to be watched, and he knows what's going to happen to him. But he preaches anyway. That's significant. Somebody writing an article about me is not important. Okay, that's significant. And when I look at this, and I look at the price that has been paid all the way through, and you get into our more recent era, and it was interesting, this was produced by a fellow from the Philippines, and he lists the Philippines on here. The truth is, right now in the Philippines, preachers are pretty safe. But the earliest people who brought the truth to an almost entirely Catholic country weren't. They paid a price so that the Philippines gets to where it is today. Okay. Mexico, I was preaching in Mexico 2001, about 5,000 people there, and they had a special ceremony honoring widows of Baptist preachers who had been killed for their faith. Now, that does not happen in Mexico now. That hasn't been an issue in Mexico for years, but there were some elderly widows there who went back to the time when some of the early Baptist preachers who went to the villages that were under the control of the Catholic Church were killed, stoned to death, shot, stabbed. And I think there were five of the widows of that era still alive, and they were honoring them. Now, in Mexico, that's not an issue today. The trail of blood's not seen right now in Mexico, but it was. I've preached in Korea. And there were folks being trained for the specific purpose of going to China, sneaking into North Korea from the north, going up in the mountain areas, because if you were down in the cities, you'd get caught so quickly you wouldn't get anything done. But going up in the mountain areas where there's not much law, with the thought they can preach the gospel for years before they get caught and killed. But there's people to be won and truth to be stood for in the process. And up in the mountains, you might survive a while before that happens. And there are preachers training with that knowledge. They're not training for a 40, 50-year ministry. They're training because for a few years, they might have a chance to preach this to people and start something and see God work in people's lives. Trail of blood is still real. Just because we're not going through it doesn't mean it's not still real. Trail of blood is still real. And you can go with an unbroken line, and outside all of that line, you can go with an unbroken line throughout the centuries, and if you start studying church history to put something like this together or to get an understanding, Mr. Carroll's point that you just follow the blood is correct. There has been, And the United States is an anomaly that doesn't fit the normal course of history. Right now, I personally think because of American influence, in places like the Philippines and Mexico, it's not following the normal pattern. But even in many places in the world today, it's still the trail of blood. And so we end up looking at all this with one question to answer. Do we betray this heritage? Because we've had it so easy. And because we've been babied. And because we haven't had to face what the Paulicians faced and the Arnolds faced and the Albigenses faced and the Petrobrusians faced, etc. Do we betray this heritage because we've had it so easy? And if it ever quits being easy, we're too weak to stand up to the challenge. There's a heritage of people who went before us. It's what I tell our folks at Ravenswood. 1934, they kicked the modernists out. Ravenswood did not become a modernist church like so many Baptist churches in Chicago did. We owe the people of 1934 something, not to betray the heritage they gave us. I've been in ministry for 40 years. I have never been so concerned or so conscious of Baptist people betraying Baptist truth as I am today. My thoughts about the future are filled with concern. And we're going to answer this question. And maybe it will be, maybe the cause will be led by people who aren't Americans. What I see happening in the Philippines boggles my mind every year I go there. I see more Filipino churches, Filipino pastors, and I see a higher percentage of pastors holding the line and standing for what's right than I do in the United States. I sometimes wonder, will the Philippines be the center of God's work a few years down the road? Maybe it shifts. But this will be the question and the lesson of Baptist heritage, of church history. Will we betray the legacy handed to us? God bless y'all.